KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hi, I'm from North Beach.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live at 24th and Valencia.
I live in the Outer Sunset.
Coming up, how the new tax bill may impact the state's affordable housing crisis.
The state is definitely going to be building fewer new units of affordable rental housing.
Then we'll drop in on a lottery that determines who gets affordable housing in San Francisco.
I've been trying for 3 years now. And this is the first time they've had a lottery of this size.
And we'll meet a veteran who cares for fellow vets at the ends of their lives.
I want to die at home, bro. I don't want to die in no sterile f***ing hospital bed. I didn't want my brothers dying in f***ing dirt. You just don't do that.
That's all coming up next on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The Republican tax bill will likely be up for a vote by the end of the week. Legislators have been working to reconcile the Senate and House versions of the plan into a final version, expected to be released on Wednesday. These tax changes will hit California harder than much of the rest of the country, and it will likely hit us in a weak spot. The housing crisis, and particularly for poor Californians. Our housing reporter Liza Veal is here with me to give us the details. So, Liza, how are affordable housing advocates viewing this bill?
Well, the state is definitely going to be building fewer new units of affordable rental housing. So advocates are upset about that. It's coming at a really terrible time, obviously, with the housing crisis. Things are desperate. Mm-hmm. So the way things stand in the House version of the bill is we're looking at building at least 20,000 fewer units every year of affordable housing. The Senate's version is less drastic, something like maybe 5,000 fewer homes. That's from talking to Matt Schwartz, who's the president of California Housing Partnership. So he definitely knows what he's talking about there. And if you were following these plans with the California State Legislature, there was this hard-fought housing package that they finally passed in September, and they were going to build 90,000 new homes. That plan's affected. The House version of this bill passes, they'll only build maybe half those units.
So can you explain the relationship here? How do changes in the federal tax system affect our housing market?
Okay, so the big picture, the most dramatic thing that this proposal is doing is that, and it does this for both versions, it's cutting the corporate tax rate. So without that revenue from corporate taxes, this bill has to eliminate some deductions and credits.
Okay.
So they have to eliminate write-offs.
Okay.
In order to, you know, make up for the lost revenue. But the problem is that some of those credits that they're eliminating, those are really important tools that we use to build new subsidized affordable housing. They're credits that corporations and banks get for funding new construction.
So the state lowers their taxes in exchange for them building housing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if the House version of this tax bill prevails, it will eliminate tax-exempt public activity bonds and then part of the low-income housing tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the House version eliminates those things. We get about $2 billion every year in California through those programs that we'll lose.
Right. So that's just the House version of the bill, though.
The Senate version doesn't eliminate those programs. But see, the thing is, the corporate tax cut will still mean less new housing. So corporations won't need to use these tax credit programs, even if they still exist. So they're not eliminated, but corporations won't need to, and banks won't need to use them because they'll just be under less pressure to take advantage of write-offs because their taxes have already been lowered. So they don't, the value of those credits will just plummet and they'll still exist, but they won't produce as much.
Okay. So that's affordable housing construction. How else does this bill affect housing?
So there's another tax deduction that the House version of this bill is, well, it's not eliminating, but it's capping. And this one works totally differently. It's the mortgage interest tax deduction. Mm. It's for ordinary homeowners, and they use it to write off their interest payments on their mortgage.
And that's a policy that's meant to encourage homeownership, right?
Yeah, it's a government subsidy to homeowners. And this, it won't affect people who already have mortgages, but it would make it more expensive to buy a home if you haven't yet, because you won't be able to write off the interest payments.
Mm.
And it's interesting because actually there are a lot of progressives that have wanted to eliminate or cap the mortgage interest tax deduction for a long time. I mean, they point out that the federal government spends more on it subsidizing homeownership than it does on all of our subsidies for low-income housing. So it's kind of bad for inequality. It's a regressive program.
So Republicans are now doing things that progressives want?
Well, yes, but the idea from the progressive vantage point is we should save this money that we're spending, you know, if we cut this program.
Yeah.
In order to spend it on low-income housing. And that's not what the House proposal does. What this proposal does is it saves that money in order to finance all these tax breaks, in order to fund, for example, a repeal of the estate tax for families bequeathing more than $11 million to their heirs. So on the backs of homeowners of all incomes.
Okay, so what happens from here? What goes on?
Well, we're going to find out on Wednesday what the reconciled version of the two bills is going to be. And it's hard to know if it's going to be something more like the Senate version or something more like the House version. Affordable housing advocates are focusing in on these two California Republican members of Congress. They have really strong voices in shaping the final bill. There's House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. He just has a lot of influence with other Republicans. Mm-hmm. And then there's Devin Nunes, who is on the conference committee drafting this final version. So that's who they're lobbying, and that's who's getting calls from constituents who don't like the bill. So we'll know this week.
And we'll be following. Thanks, Liza.
Thank you.
Liza Veal is KLW's housing reporter. If you've got a housing story you'd like to see reported, email her at housing@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. As we heard in that last story, all of California is experiencing an affordable housing shortage. According to federal standards, it's best that people spend no more than 30% of their income on housing. But a 2015 report by the real estate database Zillow found most renters in San Francisco spend about half of their paychecks on rent. There are some options out there for people priced out of the rental market, including below-market rent and low-income housing programs. In San Francisco, individuals earning less than $72,000 a year qualify. But securing one of those affordable units is a competitive process, and it's one that ultimately comes down to chance. Back in 2016, KALW's Audrey Dilling reported on the affordable housing lottery.
About 100 people are seated in the auditorium in the basement of the San Francisco Main Library. They're waiting for an affordable housing lottery to begin. The people here are just a fraction of those trying to get an affordable apartment today.
So you don't have to be here for the lottery. You can leave at any time.
Up on the stage, Brooke Barber from the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development stands behind a clear plastic box with a handle on it, kind of like what you'd use to play bingo.
See-through box, okay? That means everybody gets to see.
The box is full of white slips of paper with numbers printed on them. There are about 2,500, each representing a person trying to find an affordable place to live in San Francisco.
Other than that, good luck and happy holidays. We're getting ready to get started.
91 affordable units are up for grabs today, a mix of studios and one and two bedrooms. They're part of the city's below-market rent program, where for-profit developers set aside some lower-rent units in an otherwise market-rate building. To qualify for one of these, a household can make up to 55% of San Francisco's area median income. That's about $37,000 a year for an individual. They also have to pass a credit check and have a clean housing record, no evictions for cause in the past 7 years. And then, certain people get their numbers thrown in the box first.
So we're going to start with certificate of preference holders first.
The first order of preference goes to people displaced from the Western Addition or Bayview Hunters Point in the 60s and 70s, when almost 6,000 people were forced to leave their homes for redevelopment. Some of them are still looking for an affordable place to live.
We have 10 folks who applied to that preference. Then we have the second preference is Ellis Act Housing Preference.
The last preference goes to people who already live or work in San Francisco.
Oh yeah, one more thing, you guys. When I get to the live-work, there's a lot of tickets, so I'm not gonna turn this every 2 to 3 tickets that I pull. I will turn them at least once every 10 tickets, and then I will turn the box.
There's so many tickets, she's gotta regulate how much she turns the box. And then, with little ceremony, it begins.
696-0458. 696-0498 is lottery winner number one.
A lone woman toward the back of the room, Niambi Campbell, cheers and claps. Some people turn around in their seats and flash a quick smile. Campbell hops up and runs out into the hallway to make a phone call.
Hello? Mama? Come get me. I was the first one they pick. I got it. Okay, I'll see you outside. Okay, bye.
Campbell's parents were a part of the group displaced from Hunter's Point. They ended up finding a new house where she's been living. But the lottery special preference program also applies to children of the displaced. So now Campbell has a shot at getting her own place in San Francisco.
So this is home, and it's where I need to be. Job, schools, this is where I should be.
And is this your first lottery?
This is my very first lottery. I don't believe in this, but now I'm a believer.
25-696-1240.
Back in the auditorium, the lottery proceeds at a hypnotic pace.
58-696-1239, 696-1239.
A woman pats a fussy baby on the back. A man takes his toddler daughter for a walk up and down the aisle. People shift in their seats. It's staggeringly tedious.
72-696-0091.
And yet, each seven-digit number wields tremendous power.
91.
Even though there are only 91 apartments available, they'll call 1,000 numbers today. That's in case people at the top of the list don't actually qualify for some reason. So even though Shawana Smith just got picked 107th, she still feels pretty good.
My number was 696-1324, and I'm extremely happy right now.
Smith is here with her baby girl.
You gonna say hi? Say hi. Say yay.
Right now, they're both living with Smith's fiance in Fairfield, almost 50 miles from his job in San Francisco. They've been trying to move to the city.
And it's really out of our price range. Like a studio right now is like $1,300, and we don't have $1,300 to spend on rent.
A studio in the lottery building goes for just under $1,000.
$498.
As the lottery creeps further into the hundreds, Shawana Smith seems like the last person in a good mood. Ty Edwards paces the back of the auditorium, rustling a brochure about the apartment building between his fingers.
I've been trying for 3 years now, and this is the first time they've had a lottery of this size. So I'm just hoping that my number gets called this time at least.
Do you live in San Francisco right now?
Yes, I do. I stay at a homeless shelter.
Where were you before that?
I was working for the city, actually, and, you know, layoffs and things like that, and lost my job, and that's about it. I'm just a veteran that's down on his luck, that's all.
Nearby, Gloria Mendoza is losing her patience. She had to step out, and now she doesn't know if her number's been called.
I know the guy right here in the front said that they don't go backwards on the number, so I'm not sure. Maybe she can, I don't know. So I started writing the numbers down for a little while I was here, and then I stopped. I had to go move my daughter's car. So I'm still, like, backed up now.
Mendoza says she often sleeps in that car or at her daughter's apartment in the Tenderloin, but she's only allowed 9 overnight guests a month. Mendoza lost her Section 8 apartment in September. Her landlord decided to stop accepting vouchers for the federal subsidized rent program. It's voluntary.
She didn't want to participate in the program anymore. She was a very, very nice landlady. And I've never had an issue with, like, paying rent or anything. It just so what happened to me, you know, it could happen to anyone.
Mendoza can keep looking for landlords that'll accept her voucher. In that way, she's lucky. The wait list for Section 8 in San Francisco is closed. So is the one for San Francisco Public Housing, a separate federally funded program for low-income families. There's just too much demand and not enough supply.
498.
And you could say the same thing for all housing in San Francisco.
500. 696-0912. 696-0912.
Mayor Ed Lee has pledged to create or rehabilitate a total of 30,000 new housing units, with a third of those designated affordable by the year 2020. But for people like Ty Edwards, that's not nearly soon enough.
So I have to come back to see if my number comes up in the second half here. I'll be back in just a few minutes. Hopefully it's good.
Edwards' number didn't end up getting called. those that did get picked still aren't home free. Now they have to make it through the interview process. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
That story was reported by Audrey Dilling and originally aired in 2016. The next affordable housing lottery in San Francisco takes place on January 18th. It's for 28 units in the Alice Griffith Apartments. There's an information session for that this Wednesday at the complex. Find all the information at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story comes to us from our partners at StoryCorps. It's a conversation between two friends who served in the Navy together. Ron Ikaika Rivera Jr. says when you first see him and all his tattoos, you see a...
Oh, big bad, you know, scary looking Hell's Angel guy.
But if you look closer, you'll see a different, much more surprising story. Ron is a retired corpsman, which is what the Navy calls their medics. In this edition of StoryCorps, Ron sat down with his friend, fellow retired Army medic Jason Deitch, for a conversation about love, devotion, and service in the lives of veterans.
So tell me who Ron Rivera was before he became a soldier.
My dad's a Hawaiian. My mom's of Irish descent, so I'm kind of like the first American generation of my family. I grew up in various locations of the East Bay. It was tough. It was tough being poor growing up. You know, it was tough not having things. I had a phenomenal grandfather and grandmother that were more like my parents than anything. They always took care of me. I mean, I was lucky to have that in my life. They both worked at Mother's Cookies in Oakland. He was a truck driver, but never really spoke too much. Taught me how to hunt, taught me how to fish, taught me how to shoot, taught me how to live my life. My grandfather never swam without jeans on because of the shrapnel in his legs and his back. He was an Inchon Marine, didn't talk about it except for to his best friend in the world, Jack, which was his corpsman, which had pulled him out. And for years, my grandfather never said anything about Korea until I came back home. When I came back home, Grandpa grabbed me and he took me downstairs at their house. And he busted out everything he had from his chest. He kept this for years. He didn't share this with his, he had three boys and two girls. He didn't share this with them. He didn't share this with my grandmother. And he busted it out. And I never seen my grandfather drink before. He and I killed a six pack. I mean, it was crazy. And the man told me all about what happened. Then he showed me his scars on his legs. And then he gave me his EGAs and he gave me his medals. And, that day was more important than any day of my life that anything was given to me in the military.
You are a nurse now, right? Would you consider going off and becoming a nurse, your transition back into the civilian world?
No, because I went to Napa Valley College and got stuck at Napa State Hospital running a veterans group. I can't get away from my vets, man. So we walked over to Napa State Hospital. We walk in and there's all these vets wandering around, like total PTSD, like screwed up, like crazy screwed up though. And we're like, hey, you know, we're ready to go. You guys, let's have a group. And nobody had ever been able to stay there very long because these guys would throw stuff at them or crap would start off. The orderlies would get involved. And the guys looked at us and said, hey, were you in the military? I go, yeah. They goes, what did you do? I was a corpsman. The guy goes, oh, I was a Marine in Vietnam. I'm like, oh, okay. Boom, we're all sitting down in a group. Like for like 16 weeks, we ran this group. And just, I'm not a fucking therapist. Yeah. I was a doc, you know, and we just sat there talking. And that's all we did was talk. They smoked and joked and everything else, but it was like the calmest. And that meant so much to me to see these guys go from an element of just absolute, the world did not care about them, but to stick them in this place. Yeah. And the world just thought that they didn't have any value.
You did work while you were going through nursing school, obviously, with vets, right? And then now you do end-of-life care, hospice care, for veterans at the end of their life. You, in a text to me, you summed it up in amazing words. You said, I help the brothers get ready for their last deployment or something.
Absolutely. It's just like getting to the door again, man. Your first job, your first door you're going to kick in, your first dynamic entry, whatever, bro. You got to be, that's a f***ing scary door, dude. Yeah. That's a hot door. I lost my grandmother to hospice, and that's when I became a hospice nurse. Every time, it's a little bit of selfishness too. Even though this would cross every palliative care and whatever boundary, and every nurse would be clenching their fists at me right now. Every time I go into a home, I see a piece of my family. I see a grandma and a grandpa that need help. I see how my grandparents passed. I see how my aunt and uncle may pass. So the gratification I get at helping people in their moment of absolute chaos, their loved ones dying, they're freaking out, and it's just pandemonium in there. I can fix that. It's being able to empower them and their families to make that decision. I want to die at home, bro. I don't want to die in no sterile f***ing hospital bed. I didn't want my brothers dying in f***ing dirt. Yeah. You just don't do that.
What it sounds like to me is you found your service. You found service. You did it. You figured out a way to do it. Maybe you weren't like, you know, plotting all of this stuff, but your body, the way your character is, the way your mind is built, the way you see the world, the way you design yourself, right? How your gut dictates to you where you go, right? You built it. Your life has been a life of service of one kind or another, but always of service.
Can't help it.
You're not supposed to, bro.
Those were Jason Deitch and Ron Rivera. Their interview was recorded at a StoryCorps booth at the Concord Vet Center. That piece was produced by KALW's Kavalroop Kaur Singh. Go to KALW.org to learn more about how you can take part in San Francisco StoryCorps. Our Cross Currents team for today includes Atemu Atan, Angela Johnston, Nina Gensler-Debs, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Andrew Stelzer, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Gabe Graben, James Rollins, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Our local music today is by Mean to Me. Three of the group's core members grew up in San Francisco. Mean to Me will perform at the Red Poppy Art House in the city on Thursday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Giddy up on your horse now. What you know about loving on a telegraph line? Dots and dashes out the door, why won't you be mine? What you know about loving on a long distance charge? Connect me, operator, my money's gone too far. I wanna love you, I really do, but I can't seem to get a hold of you.